love you.
Hello, my name's Tom Walker. Welcome to That'll Be The Day. In this podcast, I'm talking to a writer and author who found a very public way of telling everyone that he's losing his sight. But before we hear from John Gingrich, if you like the music at the start of this podcast, it's a track called That'll Be The Day by the Liverpool band The Vow. And as always, I'll be featuring a track by the band at the end of this podcast. To find out which one it is, stay tuned. Now, when John Gingrich from New York started to lose his sight, it was fairly obvious to his family, close friends and colleagues. There were, however, many other people who didn't know and who John felt needed to be told. An article in the Guardian newspaper soon sorted that out. When I spoke to John on Zoom, I started by asking him about the work he does.
I do a number of things. I'm an editor for a magazine. It's a business magazine called O'Dwyer's, and I've had that job for, God, about 16 years now. In addition to that, I also teach fiction writing. That's something that I typically do about one day a week. I do freelance writing. I write fiction. I have a novel that just came out a couple months ago called The Appetite Factory. And that was the sort of the backdrop behind the Guardian article that I just published, where I talked about how I was finishing the novel as I was going blind, and basically the chaos that ensued therein, trying to finish a novel while losing my eyesight, and the difficulties of keeping my eyesight loss a secret. You know, I found myself in sort of a game of cat and mouse with reality. And in the end, you know, reality always wins. So I decided that I had to kind of come clean and tell everybody that I had lost my eyesight. And I didn't really know how to do that. You know, it just seemed kind of exhausting to go from friend to friend to friend and to tell them, hey, guess what? And so I decided to write this article that The Guardian published, where I, you know, effectively came out of the disability closet, for lack of a better term.
I saw the article in The Guardian, and to be honest, that's exactly what prompted me to contact you. And, you know, I found that very interesting because I've been visually impaired all of my life. In fact, I was born totally blind and then got a little bit of sight as a result of numerous operations as a child. So our experiences are qualitatively different, I suppose. The other thing I noticed, I think again on the 27th of December, was that you put a post on Facebook, effectively, as you say, outing yourself as a visually impaired person. But there must have been lots of people who you worked with, who you knew quite well, but who didn't know, or maybe you think you didn't know, they didn't know that you were losing your sight. What was the exact position with those people?
There was a spectrum of responses, but most of them, I would say, shocked. My family members, to be honest, they knew. I told them several years ago because I had to. And also, my sister also has retinitis pigmentosa, not as advanced as mine because she's younger. But my family members knew, my wife knew, a couple other people, close friends knew. Anybody who's run into me in the last 6 to 9 months has known, because I've got a cane and I've had to kind of, you know, I did this thing where I reached out to them before meeting up and said, hey, by the way, you might notice I'm going to have a cane with me because, funny story, I lost my eyesight, you know, which, of course, you know, registered very, again, you know, a reaction that ranged anywhere from extreme concern, pity, things that, you know, were both discreetly reasonable and also, you know, made me somewhat uncomfortable. I think this is something that I had to get used to because when you sort of come clean and admit that you have a disability, in my case, but this is a larger issue, I think, as well, any kind of a problem that others might not know about, it's always operating off some baseline of vulnerability. After the article went up and everybody knew, there was no escaping it anymore. I have to say, after that first day or two, which was a complete blur, you know, just the sargasso of responses and outreach I got from friends and relatives via text message, email, phone calls, you name it, it was this incredible wave of relief. where I felt like this incredible weight had been lifted off my shoulders.
Was the Guardian article a calculated approach from you to kind of let everybody else knew, because your family knew, people who bumped into you, run into you over the past 6 to 9 months knew, but was the Guardian article, if you like, a strategy to tell everybody else?
There's only so much planning that I could have made, because after all, I don't get to decide where my writing gets published. The publisher of those publications gets to decide that. So I pitched it to The Guardian. They were very receptive and they took it almost immediately, which I was really relieved to hear. I had planned it as kind of, you know, my own kind of, again, coming out story, for about lack of a better term, in letting everyone know that I am disabled and I've kind of been hiding this from them for some time. But at the same time, it was very cathartic in the sense that I was also writing something that I feel a lot of other people who experience the same can identify with.
Tell me about the life you used to have, the one that you might now miss.
Sure. Well, you know, I guess I just miss simple things like driving a car, little things like that, being able to go to a bar or a restaurant without a cane, which is not that big of a deal. I can still have pretty much the life that I had before. You know, it's not the end of the world. It's not. In fact, it's quite manageable, at least now. And I live in New York. So as far as cities in the United States that are disability accessible, or, you know, user friendly, this is easily the best city to do it. I'd be in a much worse position if I lived in a rural environment. And I have gotten a lot of messages from people who, unfortunately, don't have access to public transportation like I do. What a lot of people who don't experience disabilities don't know is that the loneliness and the depression and the anxiety that accompany disability, they're their own disability in their own right. You know, you get disabled twice, basically.
What were the early signs that, for you at least, that there was a problem with your vision? What made you, if you like, sort of go and get tested and so on?
I had the classic symptoms of retinitis pigmentosa, which, you know, my entire life I've been night blind. And when I was a kid, I didn't know that other people could see in the dark. I didn't know that was a thing. So I would be staying the night at a friend's house, for example, and we'd be laying in bed. And he would say something like, "You see that thing over there on my shelf?" And I would say, "What in the world are you talking about? How can you possibly see that?" And after, you know, as years went by, I slowly realized that other people could see in the dark and I couldn't. And that was something that lasted with me well into adulthood. What happened was, it was a random appointment with an optometrist that made everything fall into place, where I was getting my eyes examined, as I do every couple of years because I wear glasses. And while she was taking images of my retinas, she told me, "Do you know you have retinitis pigmentosa?" I had no idea what she was talking about. And as she began to lay out the symptoms of the condition, it felt like she was she was explaining to me, right back at me, what it's like for me to be me. And as it turns out, around that time, things had begun to get worse for me. My peripheral vision had begun to shrink, and I really didn't realize it at the time. But life just got progressively harder. I was bumping into people. I was bumping into things, you know, glass doors, curbs, subway steps, they all became sworn enemies. I just didn't know what was wrong with me, aside from the fact that I thought I was just really getting clumsier and clumsier as I got older, and I couldn't understand it. And really sort of getting down on myself as a result of it. So when she sort of told me, when she gave this condition a name, everything started to make sense. And unfortunately, when I got on Google that night, I began to understand why she sounded so concerned about it, because that's when I discovered that it's a progressive hereditary eye disease for which there's no cure.
It sounds like she was fairly brutal with you, to be honest.
Well, first of all, I live in New York, so yeah, that's just the way we communicate. But it wasn't brutal. It was there was a heightened degree of concern in her voice when she when she mentioned this to me, and I didn't know what she was talking about. So to be frank, I was being kind of dismissive, like, you know, whatever, you know, even though I was in my 30s at the time, I was kind of immature insofar as health matters are concerned. Once I started doing research on it, the tunnel vision, the loss of peripheral vision started to make more sense. And then it was really right around the time that COVID hit when things got really bad. It was remarkable timing because I had to change how I did things, but nobody else was able to see me because we were all sequestered. And then when the protocols changed and things opened back up, we were hanging out again. People were seeing each other. And then I had to kind of tell my friends, I have this condition. I've known about it for several years and things have gotten really bad. I really can't see where I'm going. And it was even a while after that until I started to take things seriously. Through my job, I was able to connect with someone at a foundation called Prevent Blindness. And they hooked me up with the Eye to Eye program, which is a program run out of Rutgers University in New Jersey. They counsel people who are experiencing vision loss. And in the course of speaking with a counselor over there, which they're not psychologists, this is peer support. These are people who have gone blind or people who were born blind who provide peer support. They sort of walked me through it.
Am I right in saying that one of the counselors said to you, look, John, blindness sucks? Is that right?
My counselor read that article and she gets back with me on the phone and she was like, I never said that. And I had to tell her, well, it was another counselor over there who said it. But there was somebody else who's a bit more my speed. He's a bit more sardonic. He's a bit more cynical. And, you know, he went blind because of a retinal stroke. And, you know, it was really refreshing talking with him about this because for the first time, I was able to have a conversation with somebody who's been through what I've been through. And yet I didn't feel like they were trying to fill me up with these bromides, you know, these aphoristic 2-cent build you up kind of feelings, which always carry some degree of falsity for me. Maybe I'm just a bit too cynical, but I'm more of a wash and wear kind of person, you know. And when he just kind of reached out to me and told me, look, I get it. Being blind sucks. This is something we have to go through. Here's what you need to do. It wasn't until then that things really clicked for me. And that's why when I wrote the article for The Guardian, I started it off by laying out my experience being disabled and how it's a very common thing where people are just constantly trying to fill you up with these bromides, with these kind of feel-good aphorisms. For me, things didn't really start moving, and I really didn't start to work on this until I could speak with somebody on a one-on-one level who didn't try to sugarcoat it for me.
You talk about life as being a bit like a series of losses for all of us in some ways. Some of us know in greater detail what our losses are. Could you elaborate on that?
This is probably the part in the article that gets quoted the most and the part that people want to ask me about the most. I saved that bit to the end because for me, it's the most important point. My worst days are the ones where I am reminded that I'm not the same person that I was, and that I'm sort of missing something that I had before, that the life that I had effectively is gone in some ways. As I said in the article, you know, we are all basically a collection of small losses. This isn't something that I've gone through alone. And in fact, no matter who you talk to, you're going to find the human experience really is built out from this experience of experiencing loss.
It sounds to me, from a psychological point of view anyway, that you've found a way of rationalizing and coping with your loss of vision.
I have to say that since this happened to me, my capacity for empathy for other people has grown tremendously. That isn't to say that I didn't care about people who were disabled before or anything like that, but it has opened my eyes, to use a terrible pun, about how I view others and how I think about what others have gone through before I engage with them. The fact is that, again, I said this in the article, we have no idea what other people have experienced and what other people are carrying around with on their shoulders. And disability really has given me a great deal of a life lesson in that regard.
I've actually met people who feel that their lives have improved as a result of disability. Would you say that about yourself, or at least would you say that your life has been enhanced in some ways?
I would say enhanced, yeah. I don't know about improved. You're going to have to give me some time with that one. Disability, in a very strange way, has a kind of reframing mechanism, or it serves as a kind of like an organizing force for all the other components of your life around it. I realize now that a lot of the things that I used to care about or think that were important are superficial. Disability, eyesight loss has sort of reframed or refocused my attention on things that I think are more important. I work a lot harder nowadays. I think my capacity for empathy for other people, no matter who they are and what they've been through, has just grown tremendously.
You mentioned there about you becoming slightly more empathic towards other people. What are New Yorkers like towards you as a visually impaired person? What have your impressions been of the city? It always strikes me, New York, having passed through on one occasion, as if it's a city in a hurry in which people don't really tend to take much notice of anybody else.
Yeah, well, I have to say that the cane has really changed my view of New Yorkers to a degree. People will go out of their way to ask me if I need help crossing the street, which is awfully nice. I don't need help crossing the street, but I have to say it's completely altered my view of people on the island.
I want to ask you about your decision to carry a white cane, because my story isn't dissimilar to yours in some respects, because I decided to carry a white cane after an incident in the northwest of England in which a child ran into me that obviously I didn't see. The parents went crazy. Oh my goodness me, you know, you should be watching where you're going. And I thought to myself, if I'd had a white cane, which I should have done anyway, probably, that would have answered a lot of questions. Was that kind of scenario going through your mind when you eventually decided that you'd have to carry a white cane yourself?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, my experience with the cane is that the cane is like a magic wand. I extend my arm in the sidewalk parts like the Red Sea. It's been pretty remarkable. Now, getting to that point, getting over that hump was very hard, because my experiences prior to that were much like yours. I had so many misadventures with reality. I had incident upon incident, guys trying to fight me because I bumped into them. This happened more times than I can count. People yelling at me to watch where I'm going. This happened over and over and over again. And it got to the point where, you know, I would say, sorry, I'm legally blind. What do you mean you're blind? You know, which is its own imbroglio of problems. A lot of people don't understand that blindness exists on a spectrum. Blindness isn't what other people think it is. I think I read a statistic somewhere that only 7% of people who are blind can't see anything at all. You know, a lot of people who identify as blind can see to varying degrees, whether it's light and shadow. Some people can see more than that. It's complicated. And it's impossible to get that across to a stranger in 2 seconds after you bump into them on the street. So the cane is a signifier. They see the cane and they understand that I can't see where I'm going. It causes its own imbroglio of issues, because they presume that I'm completely blind, and I'm not. I can actually get around quite well. But at the very least, the cane is a preventative measure to keep things like that from happening again. And I put it in my backpack for a long time. And then I had a very bad situation one morning in the subway station. And I just said, you know, screw it. I pulled the cane out. I started using it. And really, my life improved immeasurably after that. I just had to get over the hump. What happened was I was getting diminished returns from pretending that I could see when I couldn't.
Just want to talk about work, if we may, because you do a pretty high profile, very busy job. How are you able to continue working? What adaptations have you made so that you can just carry on dealing with the amounts of information you need to deal with?
Right now, I'll be honest with you, it is a struggle, and I do have trouble with it. The way that I get around it right now is everything is zoomed in a lot on my computer screen. I have a bay of LED lights that goes over my computer that helps my central vision pick up as much as I can. Some days are really bad, and even that's not enough. I have basically what's like almost like a red fog that goes over my eyes that makes it very difficult to see, in addition to having no peripheral vision left. Right now, the adaptive tech that I'm using is just, you know, zooming in and then having a lot of artificial light. I'm also now using the Seeing AI app on my phone, which helps a lot. I can use that to read labels, which I have a very hard time doing. And, you know, I've begun for the first time to dabble in speech to text, and I'm getting used to it. It's tricky for the way that I write, especially my fiction writing. Anybody who's read my fiction, my novel, and my short stories that I've been publishing for 12 years now I have a particular style, and it's a kind of a lyrical kind of style. And I guess I would have thought that moving over to speech to text would build on that. It would make things more lyrical since I'm going straight from speech to text. But what it's actually done is it's actually made things a lot more terse and kind of a Hemingway style, where very short, declarative, simple sentences. And that's been really kind of hard for me to square because I just don't write like that. So right now, what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to figure out a way to have the speech to text allowing me to still write with the voice that I've always written.
How have your co-workers, your colleagues reacted to your vision loss?
Oh, they were great. I mean, they were among the first people who I had to tell way before the article came out because I had to. I mean, one giveaway is when I started showing up to the office with a cane. So they knew something was off. And then, of course, I had to take orientation mobility training, which I'm still doing that. So I have to take time off to go uptown to the Lighthouse Guild to do that sort of thing. There's also adaptive tech training, which I'm about to start doing in the next couple months to kind of answer your last question a little bit more in depth. You know, I'm going to start using more screen readers and stuff like that. But no, they were absolutely supportive. My family's absolutely supportive, of course, and my friends were all absolutely supportive. You know, I went to a couple shows last year, and I have a very close friend of mine because I'm a big music fan. I like to go to shows a lot. He made a valiant effort of telling me, you know, you tell me what shows you want to go to, I'll go with you because I can't go alone. You know, so he would, you know, he would literally guide me, you know, through these dark clubs. And this is before I was using a cane. You know, just, you know, yeah, he's been great, and all my friends in that regard have been amazing.
What's the attitude in the States like, as far as you understand it now, towards blind and partially sighted people who want to work? Are they encouraged to find jobs or just allowed to claim benefit?
I can only speak from my own experiences. I live in New York. This is a more progressive state. I could get disability if I wanted to, but I like to work. I'm constantly working, and that's just kind of how I go. I'm a workaholic, and I feel, you know, kind of a sense of purpose when I'm working. So I don't need disability, at least for the time being. The New York State Commission for the Blind has paid for my orientation mobility training. They've offered to get me a guide dog, an eye-seeing dog. I don't, well, my cats wouldn't like that, so we're not going to get a dog for the house. But, you know, they've offered to get me van assistance to give me rides places, which I also don't need because I live near the train. I'm meeting up with my orientation mobility instructor next week. She's bringing me a second cane because she thinks the cane that I bought is too long. So that's free. They also offer job assistance.
I've got to ask you about your book, which you've just published as well. Could you just briefly give me a walkthrough, tell me what the book's about, and how you feel it might relate to you as you were going through the process of losing your sight?
Sure. So my novel is called The Appetite Factory, and it's a novel that takes place in 2008 in the months leading up to the financial crisis. And it's about a guy, and he works in crisis management. So what he does is he helps out the executives whose lives have been rocked by scandal, you know, or the corporation that's just been, you know, that's just endured some kind of crisis for whatever reason, or a celebrity that's just been canceled or whatever. So our hero helps out these high profile companies and executives and celebrities who are facing crisis. But our character is experiencing a crisis of his own, which nobody else knows about. And his particular crisis is he likes to eat inanimate objects. So he eats soap, he eats paint chips, he eats paper, he eats pencils, you name it, things with absolutely no nutritional value. The more astute reader might see what I'm trying to do here. It's a story and it's a book about consumerism and consumer culture and how what we do is we, you know, we consume things that we don't need. We're all part and parcel of the same system, particularly in the United States, which is just ensnared with this just egregious consumer culture. And then one day, a young woman discovers his secret and she blackmails him. And she says that she will go to the media and she will go to his boss and she will go to his clients and tell them his secret, which she has captured on videotape, unless she accommodates her own bizarre culinary indulgences, which I won't get into right now. I don't want to spoil the book for anybody. It's about the idea that we curate these false public perceptions of ourselves that aren't real. The world of branding used to be a thing that involved products, and celebrities, but now because of Instagram, in this internet culture that we live in, we've all sort of seen how the sausage gets made, and we're now all kind of doing this thing. And I actually think it's very sad and very silly. We live in this environment, this post-truth environment, where we've created this public perception for ourselves that just doesn't hold up. But what really gave me the fuel to write this story was this secret that I was hiding on my own. The impetus for writing the story, it was that the character, the secret and the crisis that he's trying to hide was parallel to my own, where I was trying to pretend that I could see when I couldn't. What have I learned from myself? I'm a bit more durable than I thought. There was a denial phase that lasted for a number of years. I realized that I'm tougher than I thought I was, and that my life isn't over. And in fact, you know, it's only just begun.
A very positive note to end on there with John Gingrich. John, thank you very much for your time and for joining me from New York. Okay, which track by The Vow have I chosen? Well, it's a brand new single out on the 24th of February. You're getting a sneak preview now. It's called Nothing in This World.
You got to help me tonight. I'm a stranger. I can't go talking my mind in this place, and I've nowhere to go but home, and there is no one I know that wants to help me on. But when you talk so deep and light, I can sink so low. You go, but oh, I don't think I can. There's nothing in this world. Set me free like you. And I had something to say, but it's nothing. I was just losing my way, hey, in my life. And I had something to give, but I sold it, and I had someone to share it with. No reason to destroy. But when you fall to sleep so tight, I can sink so deep inside. This world set me free. Oh. A million to one chance. A million to one chance. All you've got to do is look at the front cover, open the first page, and you know you don't stand a chance.